listening to Real Talk on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Oh, good morning, everyone. You're on Reality Check Radio, and it's Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. We're so blessed to be here. Got a great show. We've got Ashley Church calling in live, 1 year on from the terror attack, and he's just back from Israel. Good morning, Ashley.
G'day, Rodney. How are you?
Well, I'm a bit, as I said to Paul, I'm a bit upset, but I don't need to trouble you with that. I'm upset because I'm not wanting to attribute blame, but I'm just wanting to know what happened that caused the ship to sink. And clearly they know the broad outline of it. You know what I mean? It's just typical that they don't tell us.
Oh. Yeah. I mean, it's the makings of a conspiracy theory. So
that's right. That's right. And I've got plenty.
Yeah. So I see there's going to be a formal investigation. So I'll be very interested to see what the outcome of the inquiry is.
Yeah, but like you'd know, oh, well, it lost power, or went on fire, or it broke something, or I made a silly move. Nothing. Just crickets. Yeah. And you're thinking, I got a little stake in that ship. You know what I mean? Like, why are they treating me like I don't need to know? I think I do need to know. In the old days, as I remember it, when there was a catastrophe, the leaders of the country would provide you with up-to-date information of what they knew. And the captain would have relayed some information, but it's just this thing of keeping you in the dark and making news about other things and just not being honest with us. But anyway, we've got bigger things to talk about. Why did you go to Israel?
So I went to Israel, and I need to be very clear about this. I went to Israel as the guest, the invited guest of an Australian organisation called the Australia-Israel Jewish Affairs Council. So let's be very clear up front so that your protagonists can use this as a bit of an ammunition. This was not a bipartisan tour. This was an organisation that has a focus on supporting Israel and supporting the Jewish people. It was inviting me over. And they were inviting me over. They run these tours every year, and they're normally for visiting media from Australia. So I was a bit unusual in that regard. And they are typically about basically helping Australian media to understand the political situation in Israel and the reality of life on the ground. This year was different for obvious reasons because of what happened on the 7th of October last year. So they changed the program quite substantially, and there was much more of a focus in this program on what happened last year and essentially what's happened since then, both politically, militarily, and in terms of life in Israel for the typical Israeli.
Interesting. And how many were on the tour?
Three Australian journalists, quite notable Australian journalists from various different media, and little old me.
And it's an Australian organisation, but presumably they have good links to Israel, and so you're shown around by not the Australian group, but Israelis.
Mix of both. So the guy that runs the organisation in Australia is a Jewish guy by the name of Joel Burney, who's very well acquainted with Israel. He's over there, I think, a couple of times a year, two or three times a year. So he's, you know, it's kind of a second home. But there was also folk on the ground over there who were also part of the tour. So this is a pretty slick machine that's been operating for some period of years in terms of what it does. And so the information we've got, and also they obviously hook into other organisations. So for example, we had quite an informative session with the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade. So there's lots of those kinds of things that dovetail in as well.
And you'd be with a reasonably smart group.
Very smart group. Well, yeah, I was probably the dummy in the group.
I didn't want to say that, but what I'm saying is you'd be able to sit there and hear smart questions being asked.
I did. So there was some great people, and that kind of added to, I mean, I'm not sure how much I'm supposed to disclose of who was there, but for example, for any of your listeners who are aware of a guy named James Morrow, who's a presenter on Sky TV Australia.
Yes, indeed.
He was one of the four. So it was a pretty smart group.
Were the other three journalists like you pro-Israel?
Interesting, because when they've done this previously, I think they haven't necessarily been. I think that's part of the purpose of the tour. But I got the impression as I, over the 4 or 5 days that I was here, that these guys all had a predilection toward Israel, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it certainly indicated that they already understood the issues better than your average beer might.
Yes, because they are in a state of war.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So tell me each day what you did.
So just a quick overview. So the first day we got there, by the way, it was a 17-hour flight to Dubai from Auckland. So and basically we then started our day pretty much as soon as I arrived in Tel Aviv. So,
and if I recall correctly, you're not a happy flyer.
Well, I'm a happy flyer. I'm not happy with turbulence.
If it goes high, you're okay.
I'm okay. Yeah, I was all right. And in fact, this was like driving in a limousine, to be fair. So it was actually okay. In fact, the only part of the trip that was a bit turbulent was the trip back to Hawke's Bay from Auckland. So it was actually all right. And then there was a pretty long and boring flight across the essentially across Saudi Arabia, across the desert from Dubai to Tel Aviv. And then we basically started the day. There was no mucking around. So the first day was a presentation from a guy who was a chief Middle East commentator for Channel 2 in Israel, immediately followed by a visit to Yad Vashem, which is and I'd been there before. Yad Vashem is the museum which basically memorializes what happened to the 6 million Jews who were killed during the Holocaust.
Oh, I've been to that museum.
Yeah, yeah. I'd been.
Oh, my goodness.
Just interesting going again and seeing it in a different light. And then in the evening.
Yes, because it's not history now.
No, exactly. And then there was a tour of Jerusalem, which again I'd visited before. And then in the evening there was a session with Jonathan Speier. Some people might be familiar with Jonathan Speier as a founder and director of the Middle East Center for Reporting and Analysis. And then the following day, we visited the site of the, and this was really quite surreal and solemn, the site of the Nova Music Festival, which is in southern Israel, not far from the Gaza border. And that was where, of the 1,200 odd people that were killed, murdered, as a result of the terrorist attack on the 7th of October, several hundred of them took place on this one place alone. And this was an interesting site. Well, interesting is the wrong word. It was a horrific, in that these people, the previous night on the 6th of October, had been partying. Basically, they were young people. It was a peace festival. And the following morning, 6:30 a.m. in the morning, they were woken by gunfire and by attacks. And over the course of the next few hours, and in fact the next few days, they were summarily executed by a group of about 6,000 terrorists who had broken through the from Gaza into Israel and proceeded to execute a very carefully planned strategy that had been in the making over the previous few months. I'll come back to that a little bit later. But so we went from there. We went to a kibbutz. There are a number of kibbutzim along that part of southern Israel. The one we went to, which was called Kfar Aza, had been pretty badly hit, and so we were escorted around that by somebody who'd actually been there on the day, shown the devastation that had taken place, and just the horror of some of the individual episodes over that period of time. And then what did we do after that? Oh, we had another session with another speaker, who was the Palestinian affairs correspondent for the Jerusalem Post. The following day, just going through this quickly, Rodney, we went to the Temple Mount very early in the morning, which again I'd been to before, but just a fascinating place to visit in terms of the religious or the faith-based aspect of the tour. We had a meeting with a couple of different people, and then in the afternoon we had a meeting with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade, and that was fascinating. And so there was a couple of things that came out of that session. One of them was that we had quite an intense session dealing with the incidents of sexual violence which had taken place during the terrorist attack. And that was horrifying, just the graphic description of the repeated incident of rape which had taken place. And more importantly, and I think the thing that was probably most moving for me, was how coordinated and planned that had been. There was nothing accidental about rape. It wasn't as if that these people had suddenly thought, oh, here's, you know, something to do on the side. This was something that was very much part of the attack. It had been planned as part of the attack. And we know now from documentation, from GoPro footage and a whole range of other information and data that's come to us since that period of time, that this was designed to be as horrifying as indeed it was. And then we had about an hour and a half video of a compilation or a mosaic of some of the various different footage
which we
put together. And what's interesting about this, Rodney, was that some of it comes from CCTV, as you would imagine. Some of it came from video that people had actually shot themselves as they were escaping. Some of it came from dash cams and cars. Some of it came from commercial premises. But here's the horrifying part. A significant portion of it came from GoPros on the foreheads of the terrorists themselves, and it was being live streamed. Now, that's really important because one of the things that's developed as a mantra over the last 12 months is people now trying to claim that this never happened, that this was completely made up, it never took place. You'll hear people say that this doesn't happen under Islam, that they wouldn't do this, and that this is simply propaganda from the Israeli, from the IDF. This completely negates that. This is GoPro evidence from the people themselves, and it was horrifying. It was horrifying. And what was more horrifying about it was the manner in which the people who executed these folk actually did it. So it was like you were at a soccer game. It was like this was like soccer hooligans, and the degree of excitement and euphoria when they shot somebody or killed somebody or after or just before they were going to. You could not but be moved by it. And I came away from it with a feeling of absolute sickening that man could do this to his fellow beings.
There was that famous call of a young man calling his mum and dad and telling them to look on WhatsApp and I've killed this one and I've killed 10 Jews today.
Yep. Yeah, and I just really commend that to your listeners. For those who believe that this didn't happen and that somehow it was the IDF or that it wasn't something that people would do, I just encourage them to recognise it absolutely did happen and that we have evidence of it, not from the IDF, but from the terrorists themselves, openly recording what they did. So that was horrifying. And then we got to the end of this thing. It was about an hour and a half long. And at the end, it had a little footnote that said, "You've now watched 120 murders, executions that took place during this attack. This is about 10% of the total number." And that was really quite graphic and horrifying for me. It just brought home the degree of devastation, because this thing went on for ages and you just couldn't watch it. I kept turning away from it because some of it was so graphic and some of the things that were done.
Do you think you needed to see it?
Yes, I do. I mean, I went over there, as you know, and I knew most of what had happened. So I didn't learn any at a higher level. I didn't actually learn anything I didn't already know. What I came away with was filling in a lot of the detail of the way in which things happened,
and bearing witness.
In fact, it's interesting you use that phrase because that's what they called this video. They called it bearing witness.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah, so that's exactly the way it's described by those who showed it. Now, the interesting thing about this video is not available to the Israeli public. And I'm not sure that's necessarily wise. In fact, I debated that with them. So the reason for not making it available to the Israeli public was, it was too soon and that it was disrespectful to the families of the people that had been killed. And I get that. I understand that. But I made the point to them. I said, just down the road from here, you've got Yad Vashem, which is all about reminding people of what happened to 6 million Jews during the Holocaust. Don't you think this is the same thing? And they kind of acknowledged that point, but they still felt that it was too soon, that it was disrespectful. So I had to sign an NDA with respect to some of the specific content.
Mm.
And I respect that, but I do think at some point that the world needs to see this, because if they see it, it will completely demolish any argument against this idea that somehow this didn't take place and that it was some sort of conspiracy.
And there were 6,000.
People killed? Well, there were 6,000...
Come across.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I actually got some figures for you on this morning, which I just wanted to quickly go through with you. And these are the numbers that relate to it itself. So here's some interesting numbers for you from that event. 6,000 Gazans invaded Israel on October 7th as part of a planned and coordinated episode. 3,800 were the number of infiltrators who belonged to either Hamas, Nakba forces, and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. So they all coordinated their activity.
So the 3,800 is part of the 6,000?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I've got it.
2,200 is the number of ordinary men. I'm listeners can't see this, but I'm doing exclamation marks with my fingers, ordinary men from Gaza who followed the terrorists. So in addition to the 6,000, another 2,200 followed the terrorists and looted, kidnapped, raped, and murdered without belonging to any particular terror group. So in total, 8,200 people. 119, the number of locations where the border was breached between Israel and the Gaza Strip. 5,000 rockets fired from Gaza into Israel in one day as part of this. 1,200 people, the number of people who were slaughtered by the terrorists, 38 of whom were children, and so 116 or more lost at least one parent that day as well. 251, the number of people kidnapped and taken hostage into Gaza, of whom 42 of them were children, and there's still about 100 of those people still who still haven't been returned. And over 7,000 Gazans took part in the murders, kidnappings, torturings, and rapes, making it the deadliest attack on the Jews since the Holocaust. And Rodney, you haven't seen any of those numbers in the media, not one. So, you know, as horrific as that is, there is a, you know, we were talking before about conspiracy theories, and I'm not suggesting there is, but there is a concerted effort by mainstream media in this country and other parts of the world not to share with people just how horrific this thing was.
The shocking image of the open jeep with the poor dead girl on the back,
yep,
driving back through Gaza, and young kids, men, all males of course, out shouting like they'd brought home the Rugby World Cup.
Totally. And
there's a dead girl.
I'm glad you raised that.
There's a dead girl who'd been raped.
Yeah, and if you've seen that footage, you'll also know that the Palestinians who received them when they came back into Gaza were delighted, and they were treated like they were returning heroes. And the reason I mention that is because as much as I have enormous sympathy for the average Palestinian civilian and the people who've been affected by what's happened in the months subsequent to this, we should not exonerate in any way your average Palestinian from what happened, because while they may not have taken part in the attacks themselves, they were absolutely supportive. In fact, surveys that were run, polls that were run subsequent to this in the following months saw Hamas's popularity as a political force in Palestine, in Gaza, actually increase. It went up. You know, let's not pretend that we had the terrorists and then we've got the poor suffering Gaza citizens, Palestinians, who are somehow innocent in this. There's a lot of blame to go around in this thing, around a lot
They're
of people.
Brainwashed.
They are brainwashed. And that's another aspect of this, which I think people need to be aware of, is they're brainwashed because of a United Nations organization called UNRWA.
That Helen Clark headed up for many years.
Absolutely. So UNRWA is the United Nations Relief Works Agency. It was set up after 1948 to deal with the refugees, the people who had been displaced as a result of the 1948 War of Independence, which is interesting because it's the only place in the whole world where there's been refugees where a specific agency has been set up. Every other part of the world, they're covered under the general United Nations Refugee Agency. Now, what's interesting about this agency is it has become more and more politicized over the last 70 years, to the extent that over the last 20 years in particular, and Dr. David Kerman from the Israel Institute and myself have been pointing this out for a while, it has been actively involved in Hamas activity.
Yes.
It owns the schools, the hospitals, most of the public facilities, and it has been actively involved in inculcating children with brainwashing them, to use your word, essentially with information which encourages them to become terrorists when they become adults. And so it teaches them to hate Jews, that they should kill Jews, that Jews are evil. And that's absolutely embedded in their system. Now, what's interesting about that is in the months following the terrorist attack, one of the things that became really obvious is that UNRWA was essentially indistinguishable from Hamas. They were essentially the same organization, and that not just hundreds, but thousands of their employees, they've got about 30,000 employees, thousands of those employees were involved either in the attack itself or in some of the planning that took place beforehand. Now, there's some interesting other stuff that comes about as a result of this. So, for example, when we look at where rockets had been launched from in Gaza, most of those rocket sites were either under schools, UNRWA-owned schools, or UNRWA-owned hospitals, and essentially using civilians as human shields. But the other interesting thing about that is that there's no way that those rockets, because they were in tunnels, and there's a huge network of tunnels in Gaza, could have been built without the knowledge of those UNRWA employees. It's just impossible. So That then really raises some serious questions over New Zealand's funding, ongoing funding of UNRWA. So when this came out...
Well, there's two things about this, isn't it? One is Helen Clark, who I used to think of as a person I just disagreed with.
Yep.
Now I'm much sharper on her than that, because she must know. She must know that UNRWA is brainwashing the kids.
Totally.
And that the money that the UN is sending there is being used for tunnels and bombs. She must know that.
The only inference you can draw, because I agree with you completely, the only inference you can draw from this is that they do know, but they believe that the means justifies the end, because they believe ultimately that Israel doesn't have a right to exist, and therefore if this is part of the process of removing Israel from that part of the world, then so be it. Yet, and if you look at Helen Clark's beliefs and the beliefs of other people, such as, for example, the Secretary General of the UN, a guy by the name of Antonio Guterres, who we know to be anti-Semitic, and we know to believe, although he may not say so quite explicitly, that Israel doesn't have any right to be there, then you start to understand why they would defend UNRWA. By the way, one of the things that's interesting about Guterres and the UN in general is that when it started to be revealed over the last few months that UNRWA had been actively involved in the attack and some of its employees had actually murdered people, they initially denied it and ignored it and pretended it didn't happen. When subsequently a report came out that proved that it had actually been the case, they then turned around, and this is just in the last few weeks, and said, well, they were employees of UNRWA, and therefore, even if they'd been involved in it, they should be they should have diplomatic immunity. Now, that's horrifying. That is horrifying. So the UN openly saying that these people had been involved in murder, but they should have diplomatic immunity, which comes back again to the point that I made a moment ago, which is that you have to believe that they think that the end justifies the means. That somehow, that although that's true, that it's justified because ultimately Israel shouldn't be there. It's a horrifying position for an organisation like the UN to take.
You're on Reality Check Radio, Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. I'm talking to Ashley Church about his trip to Israel. Oh my goodness, you can send us a text at 2057, please do. And we're now, with Winston Peters, sending $1 million or so a year, I think, to fund UNRWA again.
And then that was a few months ago, and then just a few weeks ago, New Zealand being part of that resolution, which is basically for Israel to withdraw from territory such as Jerusalem. I mean, just nonsensical stuff. The wise thing, a wise head would have voted with our allies, and our allies either didn't vote, they chose to refrain, or they voted against that resolution. Why New Zealand thought that it was smart to actually vote in favour of that resolution along with thugs and despotic regimes around the world, God only knows.
Before we go on with your trip and the days, because we're up to you visiting the kibbutz, text has come in. Has Hamas conducted any terrorist attacks in any other country other than Israel? And then what about Mossad?
No. So Mossad's the, I mean, there's no comparison between Mossad and Hamas. Mossad is the Israeli intelligence forces, as all countries have. Hamas is not an intelligence group. It's a terrorist group. It's a military group, which has as its sole purpose the destruction of Israel, and has made that quite clear in its constitution and mandate. An answer to the question, not under the name Hamas, But certainly under other guises. So, for example, in Lebanon, you've got a group called Hezbollah who operates in a very similar way. And why I'm comparing those two is because both of them are largely funded by Iran. So Iran's the octopus in this whole equation. Iran's been funding these activities throughout the Middle East. Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in Gaza, Fatah, and to a lesser degree, the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. And I'll talk about that a little bit later, if you like, the distinction between Gaza and the West Bank, and the Houthis in Yemen, who've also been firing rockets on Israel. So there is one player, and to a lesser degree, Qatar. Qatar has also been involved in funding these organizations, but Iran is the main player. And so, yes, in answer to your question or your texter's question, not under that name, but certainly under the guise of the same organisation.
And Mossad don't go out to kill civilians?
No, Mossad certainly do go out to kill bad people and have done that quite effectively over the last 70 years. But no, they don't kill civilians. So their role is no different to any spy agency in any country. We have the GCSB here, and other countries have their own equivalents of that agency. So there is no equivalence or comparable basis between Mossad and Hamas. They're two different leaders.
So we'll be putting the text questions, even the tough ones, to Ashley. Carry on, Ashley. You've been to the kibbutz then? What?
Yeah, so I visited the kibbutz, visited the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and was a really interesting visit.
And the video.
So I'll follow that up with the ministry. They've given an invitation to talk to them more, which I will do, and try and bring some of that information to New Zealand. The following day, we were supposed to tour the northern borders. So if you know Israel up north is sort of Galilee and Capernaum and up that way. We didn't do that because that was the first day that there was serious raining of missiles at the northern end of the country, and it was felt that it was unsafe. So we only went as far as Haifa. Now, Haifa is a northern city, but it's not as far north as a city, for example, like Nazareth or Galilee. But what was interesting about that visit and what made it really worthwhile, that there was a hospital up there, and the hospital was built, I think, about 10 years ago. It was relatively new, and when it was built with a three-level car park underground under the hospital, and that was done deliberately in the event of exactly what's currently happening, attacks from the north. And so what they had done in the space of just a few days is they had taken the entire hospital, Rodney, and they had put it underground in the bottom three levels. So all of the services that you would normally associate with a hospital in a Western society were there, but they were all in those three levels underground. So there was a maternity unit and all of the other procedures that you would expect. Now, the interesting thing about that hospital, or the important thing about it was designed not just to carry on business as normal, but also to receive injuries if the northern attacks were to escalate into a full-scale war. So that was fascinating. I found that extraordinary, and it was just an indication of the extraordinary resilience and tenacity of this people, the fact that they had not only prepared for it, but they just got on and did what they needed to do in the event of the fact that attack might have taken place. And that was that same theme, although not necessarily quite as starkly, was repeated everywhere you went throughout the country, is that people were simply recognizing that this was life as an Israeli, and they were getting on with their lives, and they were preparing to the extent that they could. And that meant, in the most probably stark reminder of that, was the fact that two or three times a day the air raid sirens were going off. In fact, they went off quite a bit while I was there. And that was in deference to the fact that there was missiles constantly being fired, either from Yemen or from Lebanon, or a few days after I left, also by Iran itself, 150 missiles fired on Israel.
I got a question for you.
Sure.
From a text. I don't condone at all what they did. So this is Hamas. But when you oppress your neighbours and occupied their land for 70 years, don't you expect the lid to blow off the pressure cooker at some stage?
I'm very glad that question's been
2006
asked.
2006 to 9 was close to a peace deal, only got worse from there to now. If they keep poking the wall nest, there'll be a disaster very soon.
Yep. I'm very glad that question's been asked, because that's a comment I get a lot, and it's just not true. Let me explain why. So you need to make a distinction between Gaza, which is the area from which these terrorists came, and the West Bank. So Gaza is quite removed from a lot of the rest of Israel. It's a southern strip. It's southwest of Israel. It's got a border with Egypt, and it's quite a bit lower than Tel Aviv. The West Bank essentially butts up against Jerusalem. So the West Bank is, there's much more of an immediacy about the people who are in the West Bank. And those two areas, Rodney, which were both formed as a result of refugees from the 1948 War of Independence, those two areas are governed completely differently. So the West Bank has its own governance. It's currently governed by the Palestinian Authority. And, you know, there's tension back and forth between Israel and the West Bank, but it has its own governance structure, although its security is provided by Israel. Gaza's completely different. Gaza, in 2005, as a result of negotiations with the people of Gaza, the Israeli government decided that it would pull out of Gaza completely. And I mean completely, to the extent that the Israelis actually exhumed the bodies of dead Jews and took them out of Gaza because they didn't want them to be desecrated after they left. So when they left in 2005, they left. So there was an election. Hamas won that election. I've never held an election since, I might add. and became the governing authority, and Israel had nothing to do with Gaza, nothing whatsoever. There was no military presence, there was no governance presence, there was no presence of any kind except that the Israelis continued to provide electricity to Gaza so that there was continuity of supply in that respect. But in every other regard, and it's really important your listeners get this, Gaza has been entirely self-governing. You can't make that claim of the West Bank. The West Bank is not entirely self-governing, but Gaza was. So Gaza, for all intents and purposes, Gaza was its own nation and was well on its way to actually achieving nationhood if indeed it wanted that. Israel had no objection to that, and it offered that several times, and it was the Gazans themselves who had turned it down. So Gaza was self-governing. So when they broke through their walls and attacked on the 7th of October, it was not as an oppressed people. It was not as a people who were being occupied by the Israelis. None of that's true. It was as a people who were entirely in control of their own destiny. We're getting support from the UN and international organizations, huge amounts of support from foreign organizations, had no control from Israel, and yet decided to attack and murder people on that day. So the question being posed by your texter is not correct.
But the texter is implying, are they not, that Israel itself is on Palestinian land.
Well, it depends on where you're talking about. So there are two types of land. Remember, this was all as a result of a war in 1948. So 1948, the United Nations voted to essentially separate that land into two countries. One of them was to be an Israeli nation. The other one was to be a Palestinian state. The Arabs rejected that and decided that they wanted the whole lot. So they went to war. Instead of accepting that Israel was establishing its country, they went to war. Israel won that war. And as a result of that, they were pushed back to various different boundaries. Now, how you then debate that, I guess, is really a matter of personal opinion. For me, that's the spoils of war. Israel won that war, and so as far as I'm concerned, and I think most reasonable thinking people who've looked at similar situations around the world, that was their land. But Israel hasn't seen it that way. Israel's actually tried to negotiate with these parties in the years since. And so what they've done is they've taken certain areas that they currently now possess, that part of their country, and they've agreed to negotiate over those land in what they call land for peace. So those are called disputed territories. There's a few of them. There's probably the most famous one, the one that people will be most familiar with is Samaria, which is up just a little bit north of Jerusalem. And these are areas where Israel is basically saying, we would be prepared to negotiate possession of these territories in return for peace and for giving the Palestinians their own homeland. It's not the Israelis who've stopped that happening. It's consistently been the Palestinians who've said no. So there's been peace deal after peace deal after peace deal after peace deal after peace deal since 1948, which the various different authorities negotiating on behalf of the Palestinians have walked away from and turned down. The most famous of those in the mid-1990s, where a deal that was on the table was completely rejected, which had been negotiated by Clinton. So this idea that Israel is occupying Palestinian lands really is a subjective one, because it depends on how you view, firstly, who should have owned that land in the first place, and secondly, who has the rightful claim to it now. But more importantly, it needs to take into account the fact that it is the Israelis who have been consistently saying, we're happy to negotiate land for peace, but we need to have a sustainable peace deal in place.
I got one more text, but let's carry on with your trip.
Not a lot more after that. We did that tour of the northern boundaries. We had a session that afternoon sitting on the beach in Tel Aviv. Got beautiful, beautiful spot, by the way. It's on the Mediterranean. And I can't give you his name, but a guy who was very, very high up, or had been, he's retired now, very, very high up in the Israeli government, and so knew a lot of the detail of what was going on behind the scenes, and he told us some things that I probably can't share with you on this forum, but just get to give some idea of A, what had led to the position we found ourselves in, and B, what was likely to happen over the next 2 or 3 years. And that was fascinating, and it'll be interesting to see whether his predictions, for want of a better word, come true over the next couple of years. Incidentally, one of the things I should have mentioned, this is, I think, one of the things I think he had mentioned, which I can tell you, was, and this is something that hasn't come out in the media, if you think about where Gaza is, which is on the southwest coast of Israel, and you think about where the West Bank is, as I said before, which is butting up basically against Jerusalem on its eastern side, One of the intentions we now know that the terrorists had was when they came out, they were actually trying to create a corridor between Gaza and the West Bank. And their intention, had they been successful in doing that, was basically to set Israel on fire. It was to get the entire West Bank involved in this thing as well. And that as a result of that, that it would have caused a major conflagration and Israel would have been at war with itself. Now, that didn't happen, but it just shows you the very meticulous and carefully planned nature of what took place and what they were actually attempting to do.
Was there any discussion of what has been called a failure of intelligence?
Yeah, there was. And one of the things you have to give the Israelis credit for is their degree of self-deprecation and the extent to which they take upon themselves their failures. So that's being taken enormously seriously at the moment. Heads have already rolled. I suspect more will roll. And there is a recognition, you know, when you talk to your average Israeli, and we talk to a lot of them, although they support what the government's doing with regard to the war and defence, they're not backward in coming forward with regard to the view of the failures of this government or any other government. So they were very open about the fact that they felt there had been mistakes, and the government itself, to its credit, is also taking seriously what happened and making sure that this never happens again.
And in this state of Israel, is there free speech and democracy?
Oh, totally, totally free speech and democracy. This is a Western democracy in every sense. In fact, there's another aspect of this I really want to share with you, Rodney, because it was something that, while I'd understood it, I hadn't understood it as clearly as what I'm about to say to you. When people talk about the Palestinians or the Arabs, let's use the word Arabs rather than Palestinians, we tend to bunch them all together as if they're one group and they're somehow oppressed by the Israelis. There's actually, this came through clearer to me than I had understood previously, there's actually four different groups of Arabs in Israel. Let me explain to you very briefly who they are. The first two are those refugees that I talked about before. So the first two are the people who are in Gaza and the people who are in the West Bank. And those are the people who went off in two different directions, basically as refugees after the War of Independence or during the War of Independence, and whose descendants, because these people aren't refugees, these are modern cities, but whose descendants now live in those territories pending the United Nations or Israel or somebody coming up with a solution to a permanent solution for them to have their own nation or homeland, and whether that's one nation or two separate nations hasn't yet been determined. So that's the first two of four groups of Arabs, because the people that call themselves Palestinians are Arabs. The third group, they're a little bit more, not confusing, but they're a little bit more nuanced. When Israel was attacked in 1967, it won that war, the war in 1967, and it actually recaptured the part of Jerusalem that it didn't already have, and it incorporated that part of Jerusalem into the totality of Jerusalem as it is now. And when it did that, obviously, there were people already living there, and so those people came under Israeli control. They became part of the nation of Israel. Now, at that stage, they were also Arabs. At that stage, the Israelis went to them and said, do you want to be citizens? And at that point, they said no. So what the Israelis did instead was they gave them a form of ID that indicates they live in Israel legitimately and legally, and that... And so now they're not allowed to vote in national elections for obvious reasons, but they can vote in municipal elections, and they do, and they get involved, and they're on local councils and what have you. So that's the third group. Then there's a fourth group, and this is a group you'll never hear about in the media, Rodney. When the War of Independence took place, not everybody fled to the borders. There were a large number, about 20% of the total population at the time, who chose to stay in Israel and accept Israel's undertaking at the time that it would work with those people to build a nation. Now, here's what's interesting. 75, 80 odd years on, the descendants of those people are full Israeli citizens. And guess how many? There's 10 million people in Israel, the nation of Israel itself, Rodney. 2 million, these people make up 2 million of them, over 2 million of them. These are Arabs. These are Israeli citizens. They have an Israeli passport. They have the same rights. They have this. They are doctors. They are lawyers. They are judges. They operate in Israeli society the same as Jews, Christians, Druze, any of Bedouins, any of the other people that live there. They vote. The only difference between these people and the Jewish inhabitants of Israel is that the Muslim or Arab Israelis don't have to serve in the military. The Jews do. So the Arab,
but they can volunteer, right?
They can volunteer, and many of them do. So they can volunteer, many of them do, but they don't have to. It's not compulsory. It's compulsory for Jews. In every other respect, and I need to stress this because most people don't understand it, in every other respect, that more than 2 million Arab Israelis are Israeli citizens with exactly the same rights as any other Israeli.
I've got the ticks going off. Sure. So let me I'm reading them cold. Good morning, Rodney. How do people forget that most of the stabbings and hate crimes in Europe are committed by radical Muslims, not Jews, yet somehow we're expected to believe that the Muslims are the good guys who are the only ones who fight fair? People must be well gullible to swallow that. Cheers from Jane. I don't think that needs a comment. Yeah. Ask Ashley if Mossad and the IDF don't kill civilians. Why have Israel bombed and murdered thousands of women and children, deliberately bombing hospitals, schools and residential areas? And there's a link to Al Jazeera and its headline is Israel strike on Gaza school kills more than 100.
Right. So firstly, there's your key phrase there, a link to Al Jazeera. Let's just remember who Al Jazeera are. They are a partisan media organization in the Middle East who are focused on doing everything that they can to discredit Israel. But let's be really clear, and I understand this, I suspect, a lot better than your correspondent does. In any case in this Gaza war where Israel has bombed a school or a hospital, it has only done so, and this isn't just me saying, this has been subsequently proved by the facts, it has only done so where that is, that is known to be a repository of weaponry for Hamas. And they always do that, and let me stress, always do that after making sure that everybody who's in that area understands that they're about to do it. So they never do it by surprise. They always let people know they're coming. They text them, they phone them, they distribute flyers. They do everything they can. They go out of their way to make sure that people understand. And it's only in places where there are military bases underneath them. Now, that's the other interesting thing that's emerged as they've made their way through Gaza, is they've found that overwhelmingly, and remember, there are hundreds of kilometers of tunnels that have been built over the last 20 odd years. Overwhelmingly, the launch pads for these have been, the basis for those have been hospitals and schools. Why? Because Hamas know that typically in peacetime that Israel would not attack those areas. So I reject entirely the premise that your correspondent is trying to make and correct it with the facts.
Hi, Rodney. Can you please ask this question and say this quote, war, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing. Can you please ask how much of the 70-year war is about land or religion? And what's in the tunnels and where do they go to? Does anyone know?
Yeah, so the tunnels, I'll answer the second question first. The tunnels interlink with each other in order to provide quick access to the ability to fire on Israel, which Hamas has been doing indiscriminately for the last 20 or 30 odd years. They also go through to Egypt, so the tunnels actually provide egress to Egypt for it. So which the Egyptians say they didn't know about. I don't know whether they did or not. In terms of Israel's, Israel just wants peace. Israel just wants to exist in the Middle East as a good neighbor, and the demonstration, the evidence of that is the fact that over the last 20 years, 30 years in particular, it has progressively made peace agreements. It first made a peace agreement in the 1970s with Anwar Sadat with Egypt, and that agreement stood the test of time. In the 90s, it made a peace agreement with Jordan. It's got various different trade and peace agreements with the United Arab Emirates and other parties. And it was in the process just before this started of going through, of putting a peace agreement in place and a trade agreement in place with Saudi Arabia, which I think will still continue. I think that work's still going on. So Israel has demonstrated by its actions and, by the way, has been consecutively involved in many, many attempts to try and put in place a land for peace deal, which would have created an independent Palestinian state. So the Israelis are not the aggressors or the problem here. This is about, as your earlier texter indicated, this is about Islamic fundamentalism. This is about Islamic extremism. Now, let me be clear. Not all Muslims are extremists. The vast majority of them aren't. Saying all Muslims are extremists is like saying all Christians are extremists. That just simply wouldn't be true. But there is a small percentage of them who are, and they tend to operate with impunity in this part of the world. So that's what's driving this.
You can justify Israel's war and demonize Palestinians until the cows come home, but I can't get away from the fact that none of this would have evolved if it hadn't have been for the Nakba mic. I don't know what that is. Do you know what that is?
Oh, the Nakba is the reference to the tragedy, as the Palestinians see it, of the 1948 War of Independence, and the fact that they see their land as having been stolen. That, that's a very nuanced argument, because firstly, remember that Palestine never existed as a country. So prior to 1948, that land was actually owned, for want of a better word, by Britain. Not by Middle Eastern powers. So the idea that somehow this country had been displaced by Israel is simply not true historically. It's an easy thing to say. It's one of those things that's really easy as a mantra, but it's simply not true. And the nuance of what happened after that comes down to what the Palestinians themselves chose to do in 1948 in response to the decision to create two states.
Okay. Great, Rodney and Ashley. Could Ashley elaborate a bit more on the situation in the West Bank?
Yep.
And what are the occupied territories and what's the conflict going on there?
So the West Bank's a lot more nuanced than Gaza. As I indicated before, Gaza's been completely self-governing. Problem with the West Bank is that it basically butts up against Jerusalem. So you've got, and it's not just one contiguous territory. There's actually three separate zones, Zone A, Zone B, and Zone C. That's a more difficult situation. It also means it's going to be a more difficult situation if we ever actually resolve this and have an independent Palestinian state, or in fact two Palestinian states, which is more likely. Then that West Bank territory is going to be difficult because they don't necessarily have you can't necessarily run right through them as one contiguous territory. That's a lot more nuanced. A lot of those people work in Israel, so on a daily basis they cross the border, they work in Israel, they make a good income from working in Israel. But again, they've got their own self-governance. I mean, if you go through these, one of the things, and this is true of Gaza as well, the impression that the media always talk about refugees and camps. These places aren't camps; they're modern cities. You've got shopping malls. You've got, I remember somebody telling me that in Gaza there was one or two Mercedes dealerships. You know, it wasn't as if they were sort of, you know, donkeys and canvas tents. Your correspondent's right. The West Bank's more difficult. It's going to be a more difficult situation to resolve. Better minds than mine have been working on this for 70 years trying to find a solution to it.
We've got a few more texts. I'm sorry we've run out of time, but I appreciate you coming on, Ashley. Overall, a worthwhile trip?
Overall, a hugely worthwhile trip in terms of filling in that detail that I talked about before. I would just finish by saying, and we've talked about this on your show before, but it's important again, people want to know more about this. If they go to my website, ashleychurch.com, and they look in the top right-hand corner, there's a link that says Israel and Hamas, the facts. If they go through that, it's a bit dated now. It's a while since I wrote it. It's a long article, but it's written as a Q&A, Rodney, and it spells out all of the stuff and lots more. And if people have still got questions, they're more than welcome to email me, and I'm happy to engage with anybody who'd like to have the conversation. But totally, totally worthwhile, and I would encourage anybody who has the ability to do so to go there and find out for themselves.
One final question for me. Sure. I find it extraordinary. I find it fanciful. I find it actually despicable. So just so you know where my colours are now, that the New Zealand government's position is to call for a ceasefire.
Yep.
That is appalling to me.
Well, it either shows an extraordinary lack of understanding of this issue, almost to a childish level, which is where I hope that is the case, to be honest with you. I hope that's actually the reason. As much as it shows a deficit in leadership, at least it would show that it's not deliberate, because the alternative is that Winston Peters and Luxon understand this issue and are still making the decisions that they're making, which would be absolutely reprehensible and despicable, to use your word, because it would demonstrate not only a deliberate action with regard to essentially hobbling Israel's ability to defend itself, but I would argue a degree of anti-Semitism, and that would really concerns me. So I hope that it's simply naivety and a complete lack of a childish lack of understanding of this issue. I do think also, Rodney, just to finish, that there is a degree of capture by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade in New Zealand, who've been very clear over the last decade. They have a very fixed view on this. They have an ideological position, which is not one which is flattering to Israel, and they are informing ministers and successive governments with that view, and I think Peters has been taken in by them.
Yes, because it's a lazy thing to do, and of course, in a funny way, for a New Zealand politician, it's a safe bet for domestic consumption, because you're not upsetting, you and me will be upsetting our listeners who disagree with us, but this is part of having an intelligent and informed debate, that we can disagree and we can do so respectfully. But I can imagine that for Luxon and Peters, they say, oh, well, if I say just call for a ceasefire, you know, I'm not taking a side.
I'm not sure that's as true now as it used to be. So I know what you're saying. What you're saying is that the people who'll be upset by this aren't necessarily going to vote against them. I'm not entirely sure that's true. So as I talk to people, and look, to be fair, I might be in an echo chamber, but I don't think I am. As I talk to people, I find that overwhelmingly, Rodney, your average Kiwi is actually is a supporter of Israel. Maybe not in its entirety. Maybe they might be concerned about what they see going on in Gaza, but in general terms, they're supporters of Israel. So here's the thing. In the past, they wouldn't necessarily have voted on this issue. It wouldn't have been a key issue for them. I think you might find at the next election that the dissatisfaction and the anger at the way Israel has been treated will be not the only reason, but will be a contributing factor to the creation of a new right-wing party. And this time it will get its act together and be coordinated, and it could have an impact on the current government. So I think they need to be a little bit more careful about what they're doing, because the people that support them are not happy.
There you go. That's Ashley Church, fresh back from Israel. Wonderful to have you back safe and sound, Ashley. I appreciate your insights. I appreciate you taking the tough questions. We've got a few more to get through. I'll try and we'll get them to you, but I'll also try and address them as we go. But I've got to move because is live radio.
No problem. Always good, Rodney. Always look forward to our chats, and no doubt we'll do it again soon.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.